Hello and welcome to an episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinelinks podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at SteveDunk5 or at EverythingCanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to P. Jelly Clark all about his brand new novel, his first published one, in fact, A Master of Djinn, which has him returning to his very popular alternate Cairo fantasy universe and characters, all reestablished in novelettes such as A Dead Djinn in Cairo and The Haunting of Tramcar 015. With its steampunk aesthetic, anti-colonialism message, razor-sharp wit, and a cast of characters you won't soon forget, A Master of Djinn takes some of the familiar, mixes it with lots of the unfamiliar, and creates one of the best whodunits you'll read this year. And while you don't need to have read the shorts before A Master of Djinn, but if you have or plan to, the payoff is huge, as Clark rewards those who have spent time in his Cairo with an incredible number of nods, winks, callbacks, and more. We talk about his roots with Fire Literary Magazine, which TV series he thought had a perfect ending, what makes Fatma so great, A Master of Djinn, of course, and much, much more. While this is a spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book yet and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but please double back after you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, and this should be done all year long. Also, if you don't know, May is Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, so please support AAPI authors any way you can, boosting them online, buying their work. Also, that kind of support shouldn't end May 31st, so try and support AAPI authors all year long if you can. Okay, P. Jelly Clark is the award-winning and Hugo, Nebula, Sturgeon, and World Fantasy nominated author of the novellas Ring Shout and The Black God's Drums. His stories have appeared on so many online venues, we don't even really have time to mention them all, it's a lot. Born in New York and raised mostly in Houston, he spent the early formative years of his life in the homeland of his parents, Trinidad and Tobago. When not writing speculative fiction, he works as an academic historian whose research spans comparative slavery and emancipation in the Atlantic world. He melds this interest in history and the social world with speculative fiction and has written articles on issues ranging from racism and H.P. Lovecraft to critiques of George Schuyler's Black Empire. At current, he lives in New England with his family. When so inclined, he rambles on issues of speculative fiction, politics, and diversity at his aptly named blog, The Disgruntled Heritum. But last but not least, he's also a founding member of Faya Literary Magazine, something I'll be mentioning. I could actually go on and on. He's got quite a list of accomplishments, but he's here today to talk about his new fantasy novel, his first published novel, in fact, A Master of Djinn, which along with novellas The Angel of Khan el-Khalili, A Dead Djinn in Cairo, and The Haunting of Tramcar 015 is part of the excellent Dead Djinn Universe series, which I highly recommend and are all available somewhere for next to nothing. Please welcome to the show, P. Jelly Clark. Hi, Fenderson. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. That was
I know.
And intro. I was like, who is that guy?
That's you, brother. And it's a lot longer. I edited it down, but you've heard that all that stuff before, I'm sure. I think that's a lot, most of it's on your website. But yeah, it is quite a list of accomplishments already for you.
Accomplishments. That's an interesting word.
You don't think they're accomplishments? I do.
I don't know. They certainly are, but yeah. I suppose I think I've been doing this for so long and I don't think anything really took off until about 2016. So it's I still feel like, you know, I have a little sand behind my ear. It's a little like I'm, you know, I'm still brand new, but
I think so. Okay. Well, I mean, I guess technically that's true, but mm-hmm. You know, it's in a way that's sort of like, you know, a very, very short version of some of your life's accomplishments.
Yeah.
I mean, not that, you know, living in New York or Texas is an accomplishment necessarily, but
at times adventures.
In Texas, I would imagine. I guess it depends. If you're in Austin, that the Blue Island, in the Sea of Red, maybe you're okay.
Yes, but yeah. I was in Houston, the other.
Okay. All right.
Mostly so blue.
Yeah, right. You're okay blue. There then. So then let's just jump on that. Does that sound funny then when somebody reads all that stuff to you? Or does it sound like somebody else? Or are you able to...
It still sounds a little surreal. I was like, oh yeah, I guess I did do all those things.
Yeah. And I left some stuff out because it was long.
You know, I suppose it's one of those cases where, you know, I was trying so hard for so long to quote unquote make it.
Yep.
You know, to arrive, like this is like my first actual this is my debut novel, the thing right. that I think I was aiming at for so long. Mm-hmm. And it's finally here. And it's just that odd feeling, you know, of disconnect and surrealness, like, oh, this is actually happening now.
Right.
So it's getting used to that.
It's an amazing time. And it's funny because I've been reading your stuff since 2015. When did Adegen come out?
Yeah, I think 2016.
Yeah. So it's not like, you know, I feel like I've been reading your stuff. It feels like a long time, but I guess in the grand scheme, it hasn't been that long. But it's important to note this is your first published novel. You have written novels before. They just didn't. Did you query them?
I think I queried. Yes, I actually, so my story is I had like a huge fantasy tome. And so this is, I think, why this is so surreal, because who knew that before my first full-length novel came out that I would be publishing these things called novellas, right?
That would actually— Those weird things that are in between short stories and novels.
I used to simply call overwriting. people would say, how do you manage to arrive at novel length? I said, try to write a short story and get carried away.
Right.
And that's what'll happen. So I had— You know, I had actually a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I had written an entire like epic fantasy tome, you know, the person who, you know, grew up reading Robert Jordan and said, so, you know, it was huge. So wrote all that. And it actually got picked up by an imprint. They were thinking about publishing it. It went all the way almost to the top. Mm. But it didn't get the unanimous vote, so it got turned down.
Okay.
So that was my first, I call that my first writing life.
Okay. And how was that, people take declines differently. How was that for you?
Oh, that was a blow.
Yeah.
Because to me, what I was thinking at the time was, you get that novel out, right? That's the thing, the novel. And so that was a bit of a blow. And so
Pissed off though? Were you like fuck those guys? Or
I was like, forget this. I'm done with this. You know how long it took me to do this? I mean, yeah, I was really into it. It came close. The reason they gave me, even, by the way, this was a black imprint of a larger, I'm not going to give names, of a larger publishing house, and they basically told me they had no way, they did not know how to market black fantasy.
Right.
This was
they still don't, by the way.
Had all these they wonderful still don't, pages. By the way. So this was, I would say, like, this is pre-2010. So this is like the early aughts.
Right, right.
And so after that, I kind of stopped writing. I stopped submitting, but I would still sit down and write things. And I had to come back to writing, and what ended up bringing me back to writing was actually getting on this online space called Black Science Fiction Society, where for the first time I saw, there are all these other black people creating science fiction or who are interested in it. Mm-hmm. Wow. It told me several things. One, get over myself. I'm not like the person who came up with this wonderful idea that no one else has thought of. Mm-hmm. Two, get over myself. A lot of people have gone through a great deal to arrive and get published, or they're simply still trying. For some people, it's a marathon and not a sprint.
Right.
And also it was just great to sit back and then just start writing just to write without thinking, I'm trying to get a novel done, just writing short stories. And I wrote a short story that I actually just wrote for that site. I just would publish it in pieces on that site called Skin Magic. And it just so happened that Charles Saunders, the father, as they call him, of sword and sorcery, of this Afro-type fantasy, saw the story, and next thing you know, it was published in an anthology that he was doing with Milton Davis, and I started writing again.
Amazing. What, that first rejection, was that your first indication that the system was heavily, heavily fucking stacked against writers of color?
In a way it was, and it really amazes me, because I would have definitely told you I'm an aware person. Mm-hmm. I wasn't some shielded individual.
Your life's pursuit in a lot of ways too, right? So
so I would understand this, and I don't know how I blocked that out of my head in thinking about science fiction and fantasy. I don't know why. It was just an interesting,
like, as in, as in,
where,
right?
Yeah, like, I thought, like, oh,
why would this be any different than anything else?
Yeah,
and, yeah. Okay, so then it knocked you down just for a couple of years, and then you know, you ended up persevering and doing okay. So that's pretty.
Yeah, next thing, I would say it knocked me down probably for, I'd say it's like, it felt like a lifetime. It was like a year.
A year, yeah.
A year. Oh, I started writing again, and once I did that first, Charles Saunders gave it the thumbs up. I was like, oh yeah, I do like this stuff.
And I am good because it's a blow to your, to the ego too. Right. I mean, yeah.
And you know, I didn't even know if I was fully good. I mean, I knew I was good with that story, but I think what it also taught me, again, part of this wasn't just part of the system being stacked. It was that, you know, my writing needed development. I needed to understand how to, I need to understand the market and everything that exists. And I didn't before. And so, it was like, it's like 2.0 when I started. I said, okay, let's put away the big novel. Let's actually learn the market. Let's read short stories more. Let's try to write a real short story, not a gigantic thing that you call a short story. Right. And I think like in a short while, I just started really submitting, learning the market. I was a person who, I kept a spreadsheet and I knew, you know, how, where to submit, what the, how long a story this place wanted, what kind of stories. And I became like, you know, obsessed with that. And I won't say obsessed, I became well-versed in it. Mm. And I just started writing short stories and submitting. And I got like, you know, I got one, I got another one published at Daily Science Fiction. And then, you know, there were a lot of semi-pro markets. And basically I started working my, I feel like the person who like starts off in vaudeville and he's trying to get to Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
In some old movie. I just started, you know, really writing short stories and getting them published and working my way up.
Kind of old, it's old school in a way, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to bring it up in a bit, but we might as well get to it. We're talking about short stories. Congratulations on Ring Shout getting an Ignite Award nomination.
Oh, thank
I know,
you,
yeah. I know Ring Shout's not a short story, but it's it, you know, ties in with FyaCon, any short stories, right?
Right.
What, I mean, FyaCon and the Ignite Awards, what a great fucking event that was last year. And I'm so unbelievable, right?
I'm just in awe.
Shout out to, you know, LD and Brent and Devon and all the rest who are doing, like, it's just, it's what an event. I am so stoked for this year again. I cannot wait. I volunteered.
It should be amazing.
I'm volunteering again for it. I just love it so much. Mm. You are, of course, one of the, is co-founder the right word for FYA Literary Magazine?
Yeah, or? I guess I'm a co-founder. I think Brent once called me a spiritual father. I was like, what am I Mufasa in the heavens?
We're the same age. Yeah.
And FYA came up in the weirdest way where I was in my last year of my PhD. I was actually on fellowship in Nowhere, Indiana. And I do mean Nowhere, Indiana. Pardon me, not Indiana, Nowhere, Pennsylvania, which is Indiana, Pennsylvania. So, and I was, you know, it was a good time. Anyway, but so I was there and a lot of things were happening about diversity and such issues within science fiction. And it was actually myself and Troy Wiggins, one of the editors of FYA, as well as a writer. We would often talk behind the scenes. We had both been featured in those works that some of those indie works that Charles Saunders and Milton Davis had done. Mm. And so we'd gotten to know each other through that. And we were just talking about issues of diversity, issues of, you know, how to get published, how to break into the larger market. And I think in some point or the other, I thought I had this wonderful idea that we should start like a magazine of Black speculative fiction that would be called FYA, and it would be named after the original FYA from, you know, from the Harlem Renaissance, that Zora Neale Hurston and all these others, not Langston Hughes and others, had participated in it. And it would be irreverent. It would be like this. It would just be anything goes. It would be cutting edge. I wanted to get a lot of the younger writers in there. And my thing, however, was just going to be a one shot. Mm. I just want, just like FYA was a one time thing, I wanted it to be a one time thing. And it would just blow up and be like, wow, people would say that was like radical. And, you know, that's it. But I was busy writing a dissertation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah.
And so I proposed the idea and then I just walked away. And in the time I walked away, I think it was Fireside Fiction did an entire, did a study on the lack of Black voices within the science fiction short story market, right? Which was, I think this was like 2016, I want to say, 2015, 2016. And it was right then that, I think this is when Elle, I think she basically proposed, she was like, what about that fire idea that we had talked about, right? And I think she said this, and then author Justina Ireland was like, I can invest, you know, I can have seed money to get this going. And Troy and other and Brent and others just started working on it. I had nothing to do with any of that.
Right.
I was just in the background going, yeah.
I'm the idea guy.
Yeah, that's it. I was just the idea guy. But to them goes all the work of putting that together, making it something much bigger than I had in mind.
Right.
An ongoing magazine, now putting on cons, winning World Fantasy Awards.
Award winning. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm stunned.
I've talked to Justina a few times before. Her and I have become friends, mostly because I used to write for TheForce.net, so I was solely a Star Wars writer before. But so her and I have talked many times about Star Wars, and then now
she writes a Star Wars.
She does good ones too. Yeah. And you know, we've talked outside of I'm a, such a huge fan of her Dread Nation books and everything. And
aren't those the greatest?
She put a tweet up the other day about, you know, it's her, like, the anniversary the second book coming out, and Deathless Divide. And it just came out at the wrong time of year, right? With all the stuff that was going on last year. Yeah. And she feels like it was the book no one will ever know about. It just breaks my heart because it's so fucking good.
So, I mean, that cover
she's got a Locus Award nomination for it. Like, it's incredible.
It is exactly the sequel you want. It goes places you didn't expect. I don't want to give it away, but.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I we won't do spoilers in that book, but, every time I talk to her, I keep bugging her about, like, I want a third book, but you don't need it. Cause that one ended perfectly. I mean, there's always room for more.
Oh, she left a lot there to.
Yeah. Right. I keep pitching a quantum. I keep pitching a Quantum Leap style third book to her. Right. She's not into it. Right. But we have talked about Faya before with her, and she has such fond memories of it. LD is a genius in my opinion. So, it's in very good hands. So you left it in good hands.
I'm just so glad that there are stars arising because I mean, so much of what Troy and I used to talk about was as Black creatives, we just sometimes felt so outside these spaces.
Yeah.
Right. Like we were just kind of looking in, but we were just like, there were some, it was like, if you were in these spaces, there were some Black people who went to these larger cons and were involved with these awards, but they were literally the same names.
Yes. Yeah.
Like I could literally name them on my hand, one hand, who they were. And so we were just always at times, it was like we came from this world where we knew there were all of these Black careers, all of these, like we're trying to do all these things, but it was in a separate world from that larger market. And it was like the two couldn't seem to meet.
Right.
And what I think I like about Fire especially is that, and I think under Troy's tutelage and, you know, Elle's and others and Justina's, they've managed to bridge those worlds. And so I can't tell you how many cons I would go to where after the Fireside Fiction thing came out, people would actually ask me, like, you know, they would actually write me, like, could you put me in connection with, like, Black sci-fi writers? I'm like, what? Like, just go find them. It's not hard.
Yeah, they're out there.
Right?
Yeah,
they're out there. Everywhere. And so I love that Fire just put it out, did it so easily, made it look simple.
Right.
Right? Like, here they are. Here right. are Black sci-fi writers, quality writers, and from all over the place.
And that's what. Right? And that's really
magical about us that made us find them.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We've been here the whole time.
Yeah. It's like we've been here the whole time. Right. It's like I said. I put out a snarky tweet and I said, like, "Wow, what arcane knowledge did you use to conjure up all of these Black writers that these editors of these big magazines were coming to me and like they just couldn't find them." And like I said, part of it was simply that the Black sci-fi space and the mainstream, which is completely cut off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Troy and I think we spent so much time talking about how to bridge those two because we appreciated so much of what we got from that Black sci-fi space. But we also said we need to see Black creatives in a larger market.
Right.
For one, that's where the money is.
Right. Yeah.
That's real.
Yeah, yeah. Getting
and
paid.
That's important.
Yep. Absolutely.
That's important. I remember the first time I was like, I think I can buy a laptop.
Amazing.
To do some more writing.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah. I kind of got frustrated because I was like, are you telling me there are all these Black creatives I know who are kind of leaving this money on the table? It's not even accessible to them.
Right.
That had so many shades of so many other problems in our society. Right. That alone annoyed me. And mm-hmm. I was like, no. We gotta bring folks into this. And so what I've noticed from FIRE is that, and I'm hoping it's through FIRE or whatever, but I'm so glad the magazine is doing well enough that the people getting published in there are being noticed by others.
Right.
Finally.
Right. Yeah.
And I like to see many of them, from the editors to the people who are writing, many of them now, you know, I'm seeing their names popping up in other places, or they have an agent now. And mm-hmm. you know, that's phenomenal. And again, I had nothing to do with that.
Right.
Except the kernel of an idea.
Sure.
But I'm happy that in some way I was able to help in whatever small way, help that to happen.
Well, it all starts with an idea, right? So, you know, I mean, it's not to pump you up too much, but I mean, who knows, right? If you hadn't have thought of that, where we'd be. So, you know, you'd like to think it would have come up eventually, but maybe not, right? So I'm just going to go ahead and give you all the credit if that's, sorry. And speaking of Ring Shout, actually, just really quickly, I know these things take forever, but is there anything worth sharing about the TV deal? Any updates or?
Nothing.
Okay. Yeah. I figured.
You're
I figured.
Right. They do take forever. Yeah. Like people were like, oh, there's going to be a movie tomorrow. I was like, yeah, it's a slow down, Hoss. It's a little longer than that. Just the announcements. Yeah. A lot of things get announced and they can sit in purgatory forever.
So. And never amount to anything. Too,
yeah. A lot of times they can get a pilot never announced. So until it happens, it's just a nice thought.
Right on. Okay. That's what I figured, but I thought I'd.
That's basically it. Right.
Yep.
I mean, it's great that, you know, that I have some phenomenal people who have already signed on. So that's great. Mm-hmm. It's not a done deal.
Yeah, if it's going to happen, it's not going to be because you don't have the right people in place, it looks like to me, right? So speaking of TV, and I couldn't help myself with this question because I read it from another interview you did. What TV series do you feel had a fully satisfying finale? Do you remember that? It was from an interview you did, and the question to you was, what question do you wish you would get asked but never do?
That was one of them.
Okay. That was what you came up
with. Well, I can tell you right now, I think.
And you gave an answer to the question, too.
I thought The Leftovers.
That's what you wrote. Yeah.
HBO's Leftovers to me.
Which I agree.
My wife and I we just looked at each other. We were like, that's how you do it.
That's how you do it. I agree 100%.
Especially, I'm talking about something, and you know, I could say other things. Like, I think, HBO's Watchmen had one, right?
Yep.
But I'm talking about something that went, it's hard to do over time. Right. Sometimes you can get those 8 episodes in and give me that wrapped up well. But to keep coming back each season, I think Leftovers had what, 3 seasons?
3 seasons, yeah.
3 seasons. Yeah. And then to end it in a powerful way where you answered the big question and it was not what you thought and it was still amazing and it still held that kind of mystery and everything. No, I just thought it was really well done.
I thought it was pretty close to perfect. And like Carrie Coon in that last episode.
I can't say that for a lot of them.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. It's ending these things is hard. And
yeah, there's other shows. I'm like, you know, I think back and I haven't watched this again. I don't know what I would think, but, and I know people are going to howl and say, no way, but I remember being satisfied with the very last BSG.
Mm-hmm.
That was like another world to go. I don't know if it would hold up if I tried it again.
See, I understand this thing with us because we're, you know, especially when you fall in love with something and you get immersed in it, it's like you want it to end with you, right? You don't want the thought of it carrying on without you being able to see it, right? Or experience it.
Yeah.
Doesn't sit well with so many of us. I understand it's called closure, right? I get that. And that's why everyone was pissed off with the Sopranos finale because they're like, oh, we want it. It the whole world needs to blow up. That otherwise, you know, life can't go on without us watching it on TV, right? So I get that. But when I read that about what you said about The Leftovers, I couldn't agree more. You could almost air that episode after the very first episode.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and it would make sense somehow, right? People
go, Leftovers was such a, if you're a fan of it, do you remember the first scene where Kevin dies and goes to wherever he goes to.
That he's when he's the yeah yeah yep
yeah. Like, do you remember when he meets the little girl who's she's the cult leader.
Yep.
But she's a little. That was one of the most profound episodes I've ever seen. I mean, that was art.
I love. A lot of people were down on the second season. I love the second season.
No, the second season was great.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, I loved it.
We loved the second season.
Yeah, me too.
The second season was. I mean, the family was it. I can't remember the name of the family. Was it the Murphy? I can't remember the name of the family.
Yeah.
But yeah, the second season was, and then the third season gave me a whole bit of a trampoline and Wu-Tang. So
right.
I still can't believe that happened.
Oh, I agree. But anyways, yeah, I couldn't help myself but ask that question because I thought it was a really great, that's a great question to ask in an interview. Like, what have you, because I mean, you know, you get asked so many questions, the same questions so many times. And it's like, well, what do you want to answer? You know, what would you like me to ask you?
Yeah, so, I mean, part of question. That was my thing about, look, I'm not a, you know, because of what I study and everything, I'm not a person who doesn't, I don't mind talking about diversity and all those things. I'm not averse to that at all.
Right.
But sometimes I do like sitting on a panel where, oh, you just want to find out, you know, who my favorite characters are? Great.
Yeah. It's well, in that note, because I was going to ask you this, because you mentioned, you know, Galaxy Far, Far Away earlier, and you talked about Justina there a second ago where I brought her up, or you did. But and on your website, on the FAQs, there's a Who Shot First thing. So obviously you're a Star Wars fan.
Yeah, I'm a Star Wars fan, of course,
Yeah. Anything you keep up with it? Do you stick with it? Do you read the books, the novels?
You know, I haven't. I have like a stack that I need to go through. And I think like I just basically I have not read a lot of the, especially a lot of the recent books.
Right.
Like I think I've picked up the ones by, you know, writers I know, like when Daniel Jose Olde did some or Justina does some, I picked those up. But I haven't picked up with, I haven't stayed with the larger stories that I know, as you would say, go on and on.
Oh, it's endless. It is absolutely
in some ways. And so every once in a while, I'm like, I've got to really find out who that blue guy is. What's going on?
You've watched the films, though, and you've kept up
with I've watched the films. Yeah. I think, let's just say, like, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when Tartovsky's Clone Wars.
Yep.
The guy who did Dexter Laboratory.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Like, his Clone Wars were I remember the amazing. First time I saw General Grievous on there, I was like, oh, my God. I was like...
They just that released that on Disney Plus. I don't know if you know that, but
Oh, did they? And so then after that, I started watching the other Clone Wars, the one that's more CGI-ish.
Yeah.
Which I thought was... Like, my wife and I thought that was great because we saw episodes where it was like, oh, the clones are humanized, right? They are...
Yeah.
They have... Like, there were clones who had individual lives, but... I didn't finish that. It was so much. But every time I watched it, it was good.
Right.
But by the time, if I stopped watching it, it was such a well-placed story that I couldn't just like, oh, I'm going to pick up now because I realized, oh, I've missed a lot.
It's an incredible serial show in a lot of ways. Show.
You can't just like, oh, I'm just going to jump in and watch just one episode.
Right.
And so I kind of, even though it was good, it was just time. I just didn't have the time to do it.
Yep.
To watch it. And so with that, and then there was Star Wars, I think Rebels or.
Yep. Yep.
Like I watched a few of those. And so I fell off and I still keep promising myself, just like I promised myself that one day I'll watch The Wire, that I'm going to sit down and just watch them all.
That's so funny. That's true. Because that comes up a lot to me. I'm a big cinephile and TV guy and books and tons of books. So people are always like, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen this? You got to see this. And The Wire always comes up. It's one of my list of shows that I haven't watched that I'm not going to say I'm ashamed.
Well, you'd be a black guy because then everywhere you go, people expect that you know The Wire. I used to think this was like, I used to be like, you know, you don't have to say that just to break the ice.
Right. Okay. I'm a white.
How many times will you be asked by a white guy if you've seen The Wire?
I was a lot, actually, but I'll admit this then. I'll say that as a white guy, my Wire would be Mad Men. Or
I actually did like Mad Men.
Yeah, I haven't seen a second of it, and that's another one that comes up a lot. Like,
that's yours.
Okay. Yeah, that's my white guy version
saw Mad Men. I don't know. I started watching. I was like, meh. It was one of those things, every time it was meh, but I'll watch the next one. Meh.
Yeah.
I'll watch the next one. Then I just kept watching it. Next thing you know, the whole thing was done.
Yeah.
And after it was done, I was like, okay.
I'm good. Yeah, that was good. Yeah. I'm good. That's enough misogyny for one day.
Yeah, no, I don't want to live in the 50s.
Let's get to the book here in a second, but I did want to ask you one quick question. It is sort of, and I know you just said you don't like to talk about your day job too much, but it just dawned on me, you know, because you've whether you feel it was a calling or you just, you know, your chosen profession, this is a terrible comparison, but I'm a vegan. I used to be very militant in my younger days. Mm-hmm. And I was actually an investigator for animal cruelty. That was a job I had for a while for the SPCA. And when you do that, you immerse yourself in that world, right? Which is full of, you know, violence and inhumanity and all sorts of things, right? Mm-hmm. And it takes its toll on you after a while. Like, I had to quit. Like, it got really hard after a while. And it's just, you know, reading your bio, I thought of that in a way. And again, not comparing the suffering of animals to humans, although I think there are.
I get what you're saying.
There's some connected tissue there, especially when
between it comes, you and me, I understand where you're going.
Yeah. So, you know, this is rhetorical.
It might not fly on Twitter. I'll just let you know that.
It's rhetorical to a certain extent, you know, because you just watch the news every day. We'll tell you all you need to know. But are there days when it's, you know, when it's too much sometimes, or what do you do to keep going? Because there's got to be some days where you're immersed in it. You're immersed in this in this ugly history, and now it's present day stuff too. But it's what do you do to sort of separate yourself from it to keep peace of mind?
I think I just sometimes I write.
Right. Yeah. No,
sometimes I write just to write something else. But I mean, you know, I'm often asked that, and I sometimes say that I suppose for scholars I know who study slavery or who study lynchings or those kinds of things, or people who study the Holocaust and so forth, I would say it's not even that, you know, that we, because people say, I'll get a question like, are you desensitized? I said, no, in a way, I don't want to say that we're just, maybe we're a little different or something, but there's something about wanting to know and understand that is greater than the horrors that we're reading about.
Right.
Wanting to expose those things at times, the need and desire to do that is greater than the trauma. All right. But that doesn't mean there are times where it doesn't get, okay, that was too much. I just read something and that was too much.
Yeah.
Right. But part of it is, like, you know, I always say that when you would have abolitionists, Black abolitionists would write these narratives about former slaves. Like, you think of somebody like Frederick Douglass, right? Or Harriet Jacobs or Mary Prince, who are writing about their lives, and they would be certain to include in there some of the horrific things that happened to them or they'd seen. It just reminded me, I always think of the earlier Quakers, right? Who, being persecuted, had this notion of recording and witnessing their persecution, right? As a way so that other Quakers would remember what had been done, and also as a way so that the larger society would be shamed by it at some point, right? And so I, when I think about myself doing history, I think of someone like Douglass or Harriet Jacobs, who bears all of this and talks about what's happened because they want people to know. Or like Mary Prince, right? Where she basically is saying, I want the people of England. She's a slave in the West Indies and Antigua and places like that. And she's like, I want them to know what's happening here. And I go further and I think about somebody like Ida B. Wells, the anti-lynching crusader, who would record all of these horrific acts of lynching and, you know, and then publicize them in this thing called the Red Record. And she would go around with images of lynchings because, you know, they would turn the lynchings into postcards. And she would get some of those herself. And she would make certain that when people would say, oh, it can't be that bad, she'd whip out those postcards. And she said, here are bodies that are burned and mutilated, and people are, and see all the people around them who have made a postcard of this. And, you know, and she would go to England with him. And so there was something in there about making certain that these horrors were recorded, making certain that they were visible as a way almost to make certain that the victims' voices were heard,
right?
That they weren't forgotten in silence. And I suppose in dealing with some of that, I suppose what helps me deal with that is that I think of myself doing some of that at times.
Right. Making sure that the voiceless have a voice.
Yeah, to make sure that they aren't silenced. Right. And so I think about, like, I read a great book on how the Holocaust Museum was created and how that was like a, you know, it was really traumatic. Like, how do you create this? When is it too much? When is it, you know, when might it become voyeuristic? You're always dealing with that and the choices they had to make and how some people thought they should not make it. Right. Because there was no way a museum could possibly contain
sure
all of this. And others were like, no, we have to do it. because we have to make certain that the voices of those 6 million people are heard. That didn't fully answer your question.
I
suppose that's otherwise I always say I live my life, right? So
simple pleasures,
that's part of it, but yeah, you know, you've got a family, I listen to music, I watch some other TV.
Yep.
Do that kind of stuff.
You answered it 100%. I absolutely get it. And that's, again, sort of just dealing it back to my own personal experience, you know, mm-hmm. with animal stuff. That was it too, right? At the end of the day, you just, you know, once in a while you'd see sort of an end result that wasn't horrific.
Yeah.
And you realized, okay, that's why I'm doing it. There's
always one that's going to get you. There's always one you remember.
Yeah.
There's always a moment when you got to like, I got to take a break. That was too much.
Yeah. No, you answered it perfectly. Yeah. It's a tricky book to talk about without spoiling it, because I think the reason for that is, like, I think the pacing and the flow is perfect. So each scene flows so naturally to the next. It's hard to like talk about one thing without it leading to another. We're going to do our best, but and the summary is very long. So I'll just get you to tell me the obligatory, what's A Master of Djinn about?
So A Master of Djinn is the return to the alternate world Cairo that readers first came across in A Dead Djinn in Cairo. This is an alternate Cairo of steampunk. It's an alternate Cairo of magic in 1912. And A Master of Djinn also returns us to the special investigator, everyone's favorite bowler and dapper suit-wearing agent, Fatma. And basically in this story, there is, as people know in this world, there was a figure by the name of Al-Jahiz who pretty much set the course of this world, who sent magic flowing back into the world. And according to the streets of Cairo, news is that he has returned. And his return is causing mayhem. And Fatma, as well as some other familiar faces people may know from, if they've read some of the other works, but you don't have to read all those works to get into the story. Fatma is called onto the case to figure out who exactly this figure is, and could he possibly be who he claims.
So talk to me about how you approached 40,000 plus words this time. Obviously you had like the world building and some of its characters were already established with some of the mm-hmm. books, the shorts and novellas we already mentioned, right? This is a universe you was already pretty well established that you created. So that must have helped in a big way when it came time to, you know, putting pen to paper for this, right?
Right. Yeah. And remember what I told you before, I started off doing novels. So
right.
It was like
right,
a return.
Right. Was that just like a good, like a muscle memory thing for you right away?
Yeah. It was like, I didn't know if that muscle worked. I didn't know if it still worked. And it turned out, okay, I think I can do this. And it's almost, I'd like to say I have a plan, but it's almost intuitive, right? Like when I wrote A Dead Djinn in Cairo, I had intended that to be a short story, but then it mm-hmm. became a novelette. And right. when I saw where it ended, I would do this thing where I would try to chop and put the story back, you know, at least get it to 10,000. Then there are maybe two markets I could give it to. Mm-hmm. But when I read that story, I was like, no, this needs to stay as it is. Right. And I was fortunate. I was actually going to surrender that story to Purgatory. No one was ever going to read it. And I happened to send out, I think, a tweet or a Facebook. And if anyone had any interest in the story, and lo and behold, Diana Foe, who was a tour, said, yeah, send me that. Looks interesting. And here we are.
Mm.
Right. So just, you never know when you need to shoot your shot. Fortune might come in a lot of different ways. So when I created that first one, writing novelette wasn't so hard. And I created a world. I think I just like world building.
Right.
So my worlds always have like a lot of doors that could be opened. A lot. If you peel it back, there could be more. And I hadn't intended to do more than that first novelette, really, because I didn't know it would ever be published.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't expect a reception, that people would like it so much. And so as people started asking, is there more? I was like, okay, I guess there can be. And I ended up writing one smaller short story that most people don't know, that was recently reprinted, The Angel of Khan el-Khalili.
Yep.
But I didn't really expand the world and really sit down and think about it more until before I did The Haunting of Tramcar 015.
The artwork for Angel of Khan el-Khalili. Yeah. Who did the art for that again? I know you posted it, but I can't remember who it was.
The art for the reprint
yeah.
Was done by Kevin Hong, who also did the first a Dead Gin in Cairo. So okay, bring it full circle.
Amazing.
Yeah, his art is amazing.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I had to, when I did that, I did that as a side thing. Even before, I think I wrote The Angel of Khan al-Khalili. I started writing it, in fact, before A Dead Gin in Cairo was even published. Right? So I still didn't know this world would be that interesting to people. And so it was actually after that I said, okay, I could write more here. And so it was actually summer. I was in Europe. My wife and I, we were in Spain. And I was in, of all places, Granada, right? The old Moorish stronghold of Granada in southern Spain. Mm-hmm. And one night I just sat down and I just mapped out the entire world. Mm. I like just in one night, I just made a timeline.
Right.
And I, you know, I just mapped out, this is what happens. This is what happens. And once I had that, it was kind of like how Tolkien created all these notes and he had this world that he can go back and just write, tell you stories in it. I had this giant world and I could now do kind of what I wanted. And so The Haunting of Tramcar 015 was like my first test spin to see what it would be like.
Right.
And with that success, writing the novel just seemed the next logical step. And there was no real big process in my approach of it. I simply knew that, okay, I'm writing a novel now. So I got more space. So when I started fleshing it out and thinking up the idea, I just knew that it had to be more.
It's, you know, your Cairo is amazing in so many different ways. Like, it feels so alive because, like, literally around, you know, every corner and every nook and cranny, there's something, there's danger lurking, there's, you know, a certain, you know, smell. It smells this book, right? Like you're so descriptive, you know, in the way that Cairo is presented. You literally, all five of your senses are working overtime, I think, with this book for sure. And the other ones too. But, you know, and even though there's this element of danger sort of around every corner, especially for, you know, for Fatma, who sort of, you know, puts herself into those positions a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Your Egypt is very, it seems like very sybaritic to me. Like, it's a very progressive place, right? Yeah. I mean, with suffrage, you've got a feminist sisterhood club.
Right.
You, like, the patriarchy has been mostly stamped out. You know, sexual orientation is on point. Race, religion, all these things. And this is a lot of this has to do with the fact is, you know, these humans are now sharing space with jinn, and, you know, and colonialism has been sort of like, most people who read about it was a bad idea, you know, which it is a bad idea, obviously. You know, is this like a lot of wish fulfillment, or just you're like, you know, it'd be nice to create a world where certain things have been eradicated?
Yeah, maybe all those things.
Yeah.
You know, the impetus for this world, the inspiration of this.
Because I want to live there.
Yeah. Right. You know, like it was anti-colonialism was the inspiration of this. People ask me, like, where did I come up with this? I always say probably somewhere between Edward Said, watching, I was adjuncting at the time. I remember I was thinking up these ideas, showing Pontecorvo as a Battle of Algiers, thinking about notions of anti-colonialism and what might have been, thinking of what do you thwart industrialization with, if that is the light of European imperial might, like what do you thwart that with? Oh, yeah. Magic.
Right, right.
Right?
What's strong enough to,
You know, in the sense of how Tolkien has his ants who are like the opposite of the industrialized orcs, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I think a lot of those things were swirling in my head, but, you know, I would say in some ways, this entire Dejian world was in part an anti-colonial story, but it was also a post-colonial story.
Right.
Because I wanted to see what could happen, you know, beyond colonialism. And I just wanted to do it in a fun way, in a way that has these winks and nods and allusions to it, but it's also magical and fantastic, you know, and there are fun things happening. And I'll say that, you know, in wish fulfillment, I'll say this, this Cairo, it certainly is, it has all these progressive elements. Mm-hmm. And part of this is that the Cairo of the early 20th century did have some of these progressive elements.
Right, right, right.
Were early feminists, Fatma is named after one, for instance. Yep.
Technology.
You know, there are a lot of the things that I have in there are things that actually exist, down to women in suits. Right. I have pictures from the early 1900s of women, not in Cairo, but at least from Beirut and other places, in men's suits, you know, in these interesting photos. And so, you know, some of this is plucked right out of the history and I simply run with it a bit.
Right.
But I will say this, it's, you know, the Chiraf grid is not a utopia, right? I think as I point out in this, they have issues of race.
Yep.
They have issues of color. They have a lot of issues of class. You know, Fatma, they have issues of gender still. Fatma is, you know, she's able to make it, but she's in a very male-centric world.
Yep.
There are issues of sexuality. And so part of this was also to, you know, I didn't want to create a full utopia where everything's fine. I wanted to say, like, right, you know, what happens in post-colonial, the societies have their problems too. They just have to figure out how to deal with it on their own.
Right.
The external influence and concern. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's almost like a city in transition, right? Look, yeah, it's sort of like it's they know the horrors of the past, and they're trying to like, you know, they're fighting for a brighter future. Right. I'm glad you
said dealing with modernity, which is you know, and this comes from there's a great history book, I can't think of the name author right now. He talks about the modern world, but he talks about how modernity happens not just in the West, which is often thought about, but it happens everywhere because everyone's impacted by this thing called modernity.
Right.
Right. And so one of the things that one of the reasons Cairo was so interesting, like from the tram car and all these other things, you can find all of this in quote unquote vintage Cairo of the 19th and early 20th century, right? That Cairo had all of these things that were part of modernity alongside the more traditional world. It was just all there, right? So many of these places had it. We tend to think of it as, oh, this is something that happened in the West only, but actually it was happening everywhere.
Right,
in different ways.
Right, and for
so many of these places were interconnected.
Right, and for a more, you know, just for the people listening, for a more Western viewpoint, just turn on the news. Right.
there's a
portion of the country right now fighting for.
Look, it's nose down on, you know, the dreary little island.
Yeah.
Of Britain.
You mentioned fun earlier, and I'm glad you did because I mean, this book's got, you know, Jin, the angels are back, mortals, immortals, murder, subjugation, all this crazy shit going on, and
yeah,
and I gotta like. But this book is really fucking funny. And I mean, like, not knee, you know, slapstick, trip over banana peel funny. I just mean like
that airplane.
Right. It's not the Naked Gun. Yeah. It's
surely you can't be serious.
You're right. You know, what's that one line from that one Naked Gun? He's like, mustache 6'4". He's like, that's a big mustache. but like the colonists in your book are ridiculous. And I mean, like, not poorly written. I mean, they're ridiculous people, right? I mean, Abigail Worthington is a character in this book who's just, it is so absurd. You know, it is funny to me. There is humor. I just, because humor out of context, right? Like it's plot derivative, but it's still funny. Like, because you have this, you know, that levity, is that important to you? It seems like it is. It does come up a lot.
I mean, it's always been. Yeah. I think I try to imbue that. I even did it in Ring Shout, right?
Where right, right.
If I'm doing something heavy, I've got to bring in, like in Ring Shout, just to cross streams here in stories. Don't cross the streams.
Yeah.
Ghostbusters reference.
Yeah.
You know that if you're talking about something heavy, I always think you have to throw in some of that. So in Ring Shout, for instance, Sadie was like my wild card. Like, right. You know, she kind of brings a bit of levity to things as they're happening. And so, yeah, I mean, like, I'm a historian and everything else, but I'm also a person who grew up watching comedy and Saturday Night Live. And,
right,
you know, one of my best friends, and all we do is trade. Like, people think we're three of the most serious people in the world, but we sit around trading jokes 90% of the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? We call each other and do movie lines, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I always want to imbue that in art because I want people to, I haven't written the super serious work yet where people don't come away thinking, okay, there was seriousness in there, but it was also kind of funny.
Right.
I wanted this to be an anti-colonial story, but I really wanted to layer it.
Yeah.
Where that's not what, that you can make that your focus, but there's so many other things that are also going on here.
You infuse this book with some characters we've already met before, and then there's some new ones. Hadia is really great. She's, you know, the perfect foil to Fatma. And I don't mean foil as an, you know, enemy, but she's her partner in this book. Fatma gets a partner in this book, and
I really liked exploring her because I wanted, and you know, I think I kind of bought her in because I was getting people who liked Fatma, but I don't know. I got the sense that they liked her. Some people would say she's such a, I think someone wrote that she's this Western character, and I was like, hey, okay, wait. you know, and like she has on suits. And I was like, well, that's cool that she has on suits, no. I'm not trying to say I think what they thought I was trying to say.
Right. So.
I was like, no, let's and I don't even know if I did that consciously with bringing in Hadiya, but I know when I was done with her, I definitely like the fact that she's also modern in her own way.
She is very modern in a lot of ways. It's just
more modern than Fatma.
100% true. And that, especially as the, you know, as the story goes on, you get that sense, and they almost, there is a role reversal almost, right?
Yeah.
And because of that, sort of the sisterhood club that I mentioned earlier, right? The feminist sisterhood club and stuff like that. Like that's not Fatma. You know what I mean? She's
That's not Fatma.
No, it's not. Yeah. She's so
a little apolitical in some ways.
Right.
Job driven.
Which is, you know, great and good for her, and live the life you want to live, but not helping women either. Right. Exactly. The movement, I guess I'll say.
Much more like, hey, we gotta, you know.
And she says as much, right? She's called out on it, which is great. Of the characters in this book tonight, and this goes back to sort of the levity part, Ahmad, with the way he introduces himself with his long list of
Ahmad
titles.
Ahmad was probably one of my favorite characters.
With his long list of titles. And in the note at the end, you know, it just sticks to it and lists them all. And then the PS part, like, it's just, like,
of course, like who else is me?
I mean, so great, so funny. I love it. I love him. What a great character. I don't want to say too much because there is some spoiler stuff there, but
yeah, he was probably one of my, it was like, I always knew Ahmad's. I was like, when you write the story, I always know my ending of my stories.
Okay.
And I always knew that, and I always know like some of these characters, some characters pop up, but Ahmad was always there. And it was just always, how do I make certain that he's in the story enough to give him the gravitas that he deserves.
It's so great how you do use him sparingly, I'll say. But
I don't want people to forget him.
No, but just at the right moments, and like always when you least suspect, right? For sure.
Yeah, that's what he's a sidler. He just sidles up.
Yeah.
That's like my Seinfeld reference, right? He's a real sidler. Yeah, that's it.
And but yeah, that it's just so great. The way he lists his titles, like I was laughing so hard. This book ends is like chef's kiss. You bring out the Egyptian proverb about, you know, if you steal a camel, if you love the moon.
Yeah.
So great. It's so wonderful. But you know, this is Fatma's story. And so my review for this book is I need to edit it down because it's way too long, but because it's mostly just me talking about how much I love Fatma. She's such a strong character because she's not the smartest person in the book, but like, there's nobody else you want with you in this situation, in my opinion, right? Like she lives with both of her eyes wide open. And just because she prefers toiling and sort of abstraction rather than convention, people look, I don't say they look down on it, but she stands out amongst a crowd of people who stand out, I think, you know, which is important when you have a main character, right? Because they have to keep your attention. And she moves with like, she just has like this muted conceit to me, which is so amazing. And I just love her so much. And I think, I don't get any criticism of her. I don't understand it. I don't get it. Like, I literally think it's chemical with her. I think like, what is that theory of attraction? Like, I don't even think you can help but like her. And I think that's the way she moves through this book. And I think that's the way you write her. I think
it's how she has to move through. She moves through the world knowing exactly who she is.
Yeah. Right.
And she has to.
I agree.
She has to know who she is, and you know, and part of it, she just, and at the end of the day, this is just her.
Right.
Like, she's not putting on or anything. This is who she is.
Right. She's standing out by not trying to stand out. Right. And she's so authentic, and she's so three-dimensional, and her relationship with CD is so fantastic. Yeah. And nothing to me, the best ways is the opening. It's not the opening scene of the book. I guess it's the second scene with her, but it's the first time we see her in this book. You know, when she's sort of in that little undercover thing going on.
Yeah.
And I think that describes that whole scene is her to a T. And I think it's you, if you carry that with you through the rest of the book, everything else makes so much sense with her.
Right. Yeah. I definitely wanted to set her, you know, cause I was like, not everyone will have read the other books. It's like the way people have asked me, do I need to read the others? And I would say, look, you don't have to, you can read this book. I said, but you get so many nice little tweaks and Easter eggs if you
Yeah, right.
I always say I reward the people who read the others. I mean, why would you not?
That's a great way to put it. You don't have to, but man, the payoff is huge if you do.
Yeah, the payoffs are great. Yeah. And so, but you know, if you're just starting, it's like you have to do that so that people know who this character is.
Right. Because I mean, you know, on the surface, she's got that classic sleuth type of charm, charisma, style, despair, right? For sure. And, you know, she's full of wit and stuff like that. But there's just something more with her that just, again, in a sea of colors, her colors seem to shine brightest. It's so amazing. Right, and that's important. Obviously, main character is vitally important in this, obviously. So, you know, what was it about Fatma when you were sort of coming up with you know, her way back when now? It was years ago now. But yeah. What was it about her in particular where, like, maybe a light bulb went off and you're like, there's my lead that's character. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think with Digit and Cairo, like, I think when the idea first came to me, I saw Fatma in some way, right? Yeah. And I saw her in the dead gym. I knew immediately that's what the story, that scene, the beginning scene, I knew, oh, this is a story. I didn't know where I was going, what it was going to do, but I knew that was it.
Right.
And so part of it was, again, when I think about her being self-aware, I knew that she was going to be this woman in this world that for all its boasted modernity is still 1912.
Yeah, right.
You know, men are still men. She's a woman who dresses in men's clothing. I kind of alluded to her sexuality, though I didn't center that, but people figured that out pretty soon.
Yep.
And that, you know, she's a smaller individual. She's not like tall and broad, so she's kind of small. And I thought of, like, what would it be like for her to have gone through the ministry as, like, you know, one of the first women to be a younger woman. She's also younger, right? So she has all these things going on. There are issues of class or where she's from. She's from the South, but this is Cairo, right? She's darker skinned. And, you know, so there are all of these things that she has to deal with. And I was like, how is she going to move in these spaces? Right. And I said, what she's going to do is she's going to decide she's going to move like a boss, basically, when she's there. Right.
Right. Yeah.
She has to deal with supernatural beings who are much stronger and much more powerful.
Right.
She has to stand up to, you know, 12-foot djinns, everything. So how does she deal with that? Right. Knowing that she's supposed to be a person in authority here as this investigator when she whips out that badge.
Right.
And so all of that went into. And I think as I wrote her, and I don't know if that I was thinking this, you know, I didn't jot down notes. This is what she's going to be like.
Right.
But I started writing the story and I started writing her. It became like, well, how is she going to react to this? Mm-hmm. Right? Is she going to shrink away? Is she going to stand up? Is she going to retort back? And I think her persona was just kind of drawn out of that as I started thinking about how she would move in these spaces, how she would have to react to these various things in order to hold her own.
And she does. And she's great. And you're right. I mean, it's this, you just feel like this, there's this confidence that, you know, you've got when she's involved and there is, you know, there
still
is
also has her own issues.
Well, there's a scene. I was going to say, there's a scene sort of about 2/3 of the way through where her wall breaks a little bit. We won't say why, but you know, there's an incident and she's forced to sort of like, she retracts really kind of for the first time. And,
that was a hard incident to write.
I'll bet. It's really great. I actually, you know, I've reread just especially the immediately aftermath part. I've reread that part a few times and so well written, Fan. It's so great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That part was like one of those, like,
it's important.
Not because it's like a, you know, there are all ways that could be done wrong. It could be taken wrong. And so, you know, I think I really tried and I hope that it comes off.
It comes off great because you know, you spend a lot of time with this person who we think is infallible. And for sure we have that, it's first person. So we have that great inward, that internal monologue. So, you know, we know the outside doesn't always match the inside, but you know, that scene in particular though, where her walls do come down and it's really great. Master of Djinn comes out May 11th. Do you have somewhere local or anything you'd like to pump up that's doing maybe a special, signed book or anything like that?
I cannot remember because
tell you what, pjellyclark.com is probably on there, right?
pjellyclark.com, also at pjellyclark Instagram, which is where I tend to be a lot. I have a small tour, virtual book tour that is ongoing. And so I'll be doing various interviews, and on, I can't remember if I'm doing something that May 11th, but I am doing various things throughout the week.
Okay. Obviously, around here, we support local independent shops. If you can, yes. bookshop.org is always a great place to start if you don't know where your local shop is. Fenn, I can't thank you enough for this. I know you're a busy guy, and I really appreciate you squeezing me in. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you. This is a great conversation.
I'm no bullshit, so when I tell you I like something, I mean it. I loved this book. I've been thinking about this world ever since I read it. And like I said, I've got 3 pages just on FatMod. I'm going to have to edit that down. It's too long. But I really can't wait for people to read it. And again, you don't need to read the other ones, but man, the payoff is huge if you do. So I encourage you going to tor.com and anywhere else, and you can find the previous ones on there. And I think one of them's up just for free, isn't it?
At least two of them, right?
Like, that's what I mean. And the ones that aren't are, God, it's so cheap.
$3.99.
Right? I mean, that's the best deal. And that's the best deal in town. Yeah. Fenn, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. Have a great release week. I know you're going to be busy, and so try and get some rest if you can. There you have it, another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Mr. Clark for taking the time to chat with me. He's so busy, and I really can't thank him enough for squeezing me in to talk about what will undoubtedly be one of my favorite books this year. To order Master of Gin, head on over to pjellyclark.com to get yourself a copy. Trust me, you'll want this book sitting on your shelf. As a reminder, it is Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, so please support AAPI authors all month long, even all year long. And as always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.